Okay, today is June 2nd, 2018. I'm Sarah Lang with the Oral History Program at UW-Madison. I'm talking with Marta Gomez, book artist, UW alum, and head of the Book Conservation Laboratory at Memorial Library, and Ivan Saul, emeritus professor of philosophy at the UW and co-founder with Marta Gomez of Tiramisu Press. So I thought, first of all, maybe you could talk about how Tiramisu Press started.
Well, I believe Marta may have mentioned this, but Marta had already been working on books with a different name for her work, mm-hmm. and she, the Pijaos Press, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she found out that that was actually in use somewhere in South America.
In Colombia.
And at the time, I'd been spending a lot of time in Italy, and we were very interested in Italian food, and we knew about tiramisu, which is this dessert, and very popular all over Italy, but particularly in Tuscany. And it occurred to me that there was a word play in the title. Tirare is to has many meanings, but it means to lift, pick up, and tira, lift me up, is really what it means, and that meant there's some coffee in that dessert, and it's supposed to lift you up for various reasons. But we also thought it would be a nice name for books because you pick them up. It's an art form you pick up, and we thought it sounded cool, tiramisu. So it started Tiramisu Press, and that came in with my collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first tiramisu book was the book first book we did together.
Okay.
So it was a confluence of things. And Marta had been doing what most book artists do, which is to find poetry, preferably in the public domain, really nice things, and make a beautiful abode for the thing. And she wanted to break out of that. She wasn't sure how, but she wanted to break out. So she asked me if I had anything. And it occurred to me that I had been writing non-academic things, kept a notebook at that time, before I had things on the computer, a notebook of aphorisms. I'd always been interested in aphorisms. I was interested in a philosopher who was a master of aphorism, Nietzsche. And I had this idea, had nothing to do with this kind of publication, I thought maybe a regular publication, of collecting famous aphorisms and writing counter-aphorisms. But my idea was for rather much more voluminous volume, and it'd be published somewhere, maybe. And I said, well, you know, did I have anything? I had that, but scattered very. And she said, oh, that would be interesting. Maybe you could give those to me and I could make a book. And I thought that was an intriguing idea, but I was busy with my other things, my academic things, and a lot of traveling at that time. So I said, oh yeah, we'll do it sometime. She said, no, just, I mean, soon, sort of pushed it. And I said, well, you know, I have, she said, doesn't have to be that many, you know, it's not going to be a big published book. These books have rather limited size texts. So with some prodding from Marta, I won't say reluctantly, because I liked the idea, I just thought I don't have all that much time. I started to gather these things that I had, and as I gathered them and thought of presenting them, I wrote a few more and I changed them, and I did some work, and then I gave her these things. And I went off somewhere, I remember.
Germany,
Italy, I don't know exactly. And when I saw the book, I was astounded by how beautiful it was. And Marta had also mentioned she was going to have another collaborator, Phyllis McGibbon, do some lithos. And I thought, oh, illustrations, I'm not sure I liked that, but I didn't say anything. But then I saw, when it came together, it surpassed all of my expectations and hopes, and you know, I was really enchanted with this, and I don't know who suggested it, but we soon decided, and I was very eager, we'll do another thing, because I realized that I had another project.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I'd written an article, actually, on Hegel. And it was about how we point to things with language that are present to us, using demonstrative, this, that, you know, and this table and so on. And as I was writing that article, I thought, it's about what it is, what's the present that we live in. And I realized that there was a very popular philosophical theory that the present doesn't have duration. It's the point at which the future becomes the past, which always seemed to me very interesting. But I thought, you're all supposed to, also, the advice is to live in the present. How do these two fit together? They don't fit together very well. I don't know what it means to live in a durationless point at which the future becomes the past. You couldn't have plans, you couldn't have memories. So I thought, this is really interesting, and this is not a, I've never seen this treated in philosophy, but it's philosophical, but it doesn't seem to be a standard academic topic. So I thought, that might be interesting to write in a non-academic way.
Mm-hmm.
So, sort of very much inspired by what Martha and Phyllis had put together with my writings in the first book, I sat down and started working on a text, and I found, this was sort of beginning of something else in that book, that I was already thinking visually about the book in which it would be. And I wrote the text and I said, I think it would be nice to have two images, which I didn't draw or even have visualized, but I had an idea of certain descriptions of what they would be like.
Mm-hmm.
And they represented two notions of the present, this present that's a point, and the present that I was talking about, which has dimension but no clear boundaries. We don't know where it stops, but we know it's not a point, the one you can live in. And I think I went off again somewhere. And when they just put together, I thought, this spectacular, small but spectacular book. It was very satisfying. And by then I was hooked.
And what was the name of this one?
This book was called Carpe Diem, which is seize the day, which also means live in the present. I think by that point I was very, very enthusiastic to keep working together.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting how things developed from there, because the pages with the lithos were not just normal pages, they were fold-outs. And to make these fold-outs in the shapes, these lithos had to be trimmed.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sort of long, pennant-like triangular forms. And Martha saved them because they were in a beautiful Japanese paper.
Yeah, they were
gorgeous. And they were just really beautiful.
And they were, again, Phyllis had done these beautiful lithos.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very atmospheric. The part that was stealing the piece that I had to trim from the folded image. And it was a piece that had, it was like a folio.
Mm-hmm.
It had that kind of possibility of sewing it into a book with that very long kind of wing structure. And I saved them, and so I thought, maybe I would like to sew it. And first I thought, I'm just going to sew it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was just, it would have been just an object in itself with a nice sewing on it. So I talked to Ivan and I said, look at this, maybe we could write something, but it's going to be one of a kind. This is the only one I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so then he thought about, but just one, you know?
So I thought about it, and what struck me was that these were very elongated right triangles. And so it was, there was a book that I thought, well, maybe we should, I should write something that has to do with this physical reality, which are triangles. I'll write something about triangles. And as I started to write, I started to get ideas that had to do with the play between geometric triangles and triangular human relationships. And at first I thought, this will be cute, and I'm not going to write a lot of text for this book because of the shape was not really friendly to big texts. It was very, didn't have much altitude. But I realized the ideas started to come. They started to just pour in, and I was got involved, and I said, Martha, let's not just do this book. We'll do this book, but then we'll do another book, which is going to be, because I can't put much, because I had more ideas than I could possibly put in here. I said, we'll do another triangular book about this. So Martha put this together, this beautiful, one-of-a-kind book, which for me was, you know, just think about someone who writes for publication, and you know, you write an article, and I don't know how many, it was still the hard print days, so there were several thousand things around the world in libraries, and this would be in, you know, write for this one thing. So also, you know, just that I wanted to get it out there. So the ideas were kind of interesting. So we decided to do this other book. So we called this first one, I said, let's call it Triangulation, but with a try, with a Y. Because I was interested in wordplay in this book. And so that was done. It was really nice. And then it was actually the coolest title. And then we had to name the big book, which became one of, I think, major, most known works.
And the largest edition. I went for 90 because my editions had progressed, they were selling out, and I thought maybe a 90 won't be too bad.
How big was Carpe Diem? 60? 60. And Carpe Diem just went. I mean, it just went. We had to hang on to a few to keep at the end. And I thought, wow, people really want this, and they're willing to pay prices that seemed consonant with the labor, or at least they were attractive enough. So we thought, well, let's do this one. And this became really, I think of all of, I mean, there's some books in which I play a very minor role. You know, I'm sort of an add-on at the end. I mean, there are few of the one-of-a-kinds, particularly some of the pyramidal things like Cheops or something. I just write a page or two, a title, and funny colophon, that's it, and a couple of words. But this one, I think, is the most sort of interlaced Even Steven thing, because I was already thinking, because of that other book and the fact that I was writing to the physicality of the book, that I was thinking about visual things and structural things. So this is the one I probably had a lot of input about how to do this. And that book realizes an idea that was circulating in the book art world, but there's a lot of lip service to it. I don't think it was very often gone after, because it's, you can't do it with every subject, which was integrate the structure, the physical text, and the content of the text somehow. They have to do with each other, not just one is pretty paper and some nice pictures and a nice text, but actually the structure is in the theme, and the theme's about the structure. So this book opens up into various shapes that are discussed in the text. So this book has really high integration of physical form and content, and also very high integration of our input, because we went back and forth, and we also, it's a sort of funny thing that we both reminded of this morning in preparation, and we're thinking about this, was
And it's one moment, yeah. And it's probably the only time we have had some conflict.
Okay.
Because mm-hmm. Ivan had never collaborated with anybody
mm-hmm.
in any of his academic work,
mm-hmm.
and the collaborations with Phyllis, but Phyllis and I were the most, you know, kind of the ones that designed and printed, and Ivan had, yes, you said for Carpe Diem, you said the two images, but he didn't really explain in any way, but it should be, you know, and that I figured out how the images should yeah. be rendered. And this one, it was going to be just the two of us. And since everything had been so smooth and it was working out so well, and we have decided on the structure and the size and the papers we're going to use and this and that.
All of us, we did and, together. I mean, we sat down and we actually had these discussions about the dimensions of this book. I remember that Martha said, I said, no, it's not going to have enough room for text yet. This side has to be a little longer, you know. And we really discussed this very minutely, and I just remember that. It was very minutely.
And I even worked on the text much before I started, because I was more just planning all the physicality of the book. And he was working on the essay and working it out. And then I studied the setting of the type. And
this book is a right triangle with a hypotenuse going from the lower left to the upper right corner. And the pages that don't open up, that remain triangular, you have to have a text that mirrors the triangular shape of the book. It has to be set according to the triangle. It's not a square in the triangle. The text is triangular set. And in book art, you don't use too many hyphens. That's considered not elegant. So you have to do it with small variations in the spacing,
okay.
which at that time you couldn't do in a computer, not that we ever used computers. So Martha would call up, and I had worked on these texts. They were not that big. They were more like poems. And I had really written and rewritten, figured I got, I said them exactly the way I want to say it. And she said, you know, that third line, it's got three characters too long. You've got to rewrite it so that third line has... And I was first appalled by this. I said, you know, this is not a constraint that makes sense. So she said, but no, I can't, you know.
I have tried everything possible.
No,
I really spaced it differently.
No,
I was
work.
Just changing. And it was primarily in the shapes of the parallelogram.
Yeah, we had
because that was
we had a page that
challenging.
Was a parallelogram. We had others were triangles and so on. So it had to parallel the sides of these irregular. So I would say, well, you know, I thought very put upon by this, and I sort of sat down and I figured out how to do this, and I learned something really important, that the language is much richer in resources than you think. You think there's only one way to say it exactly the way you want to say it. And then it turned out I was able to say it as in a way that pleased me as much, making some changes, which I wouldn't have thought possible. In some cases, I liked the second one better. But I very rarely thought I had really compromised. You know, I didn't feel compromised in a bad sense at all. So that was interesting, because I was working on something else here, and I get these phone calls. Line 3 on this page, it's got to be a few letters longer. Can you change the word? This book does really represent, and you know, we picked out images together,
mm-hmm.
everything we did together. And that book, I was very happy with the way the book came out. I was it was a voyage of discovery in a sense that all these ideas were able to come out with this kind of shape magic that I first thought of just jokey, but there were certain parts where it just it came together in ways that were really unusual.
Yeah.
So we're very happy with that book, and it got a tremendously positive reception.
Can you talk a little bit about that? What do you mean when you say it got positive reception?
Well, you know, I checked today because I've forgotten this, but I have a record of these things, and when we were working, I counted 49 shows.
Okay.
Martha had a few before I, so Martha's probably been in 50 mm-hmm. some shows, and there were 8. Most book art is done in group shows because mm-hmm. the work is small, but there are 8 one press shows, and some. It's so everybody who looked at it in this country wanted to have it. I mean, they're very, very positive in terms of sales here, both through dealers. At that point, we had developed these dealers, some by recommendation by other people, some few of them we went talked to them, but most of them through other people calling their attention to us, and they would say we. So we had, I think, 4 or 5 dealers around the country. And also there were some direct sales, and people seemed very excited about this book. And I would go to Europe at this point, and I decided to try to sell the work there. And it sold, particularly this one, in great places. The French Bibliothèque Nationale, the Italian equivalent, there were a couple of really good ones in Germany, one the Bavarian State Library,
and they had already, some of them had already collected, because I think most Red Bull collections like to collect people that they think are going to keep working on those books. And at mm-hmm. the time, I thought it was going to be forever working, and they were very excited about, and they had also acquired in Germany.
Well, I don't remember exactly when I hit the shores there, whether I already had the triangulation book. I think some of them I had already sold.
You were in Budapest, I remember, because Rainer, your friend, was with us when I showed you Carpe Diem. I had finished it here.
Right.
And he was spending a semester in Budapest, and I brought it.
I think after Carpe Diem, after the first couple we did together, I started showing them. And I think by the time we had triangles,
mm-hmm.
Some of them would return visits to people already looking. But everybody who had bought before just said, oh yes, we must have this. And there were a couple of new ones. So we, you know, I did that, and that was fun. I met people and actually had some commercial experience for the first time in my life. And it was kind of interesting and exciting. And then we, what was the next book after? Oh, yes.
Colon.
Then the next sort of big project we did together was the Colon book, which mm-hmm. was also a very jokey book. And that had an interesting genesis. Someone who had seen our work in California was doing a show for whatever it was, the bicentennial, must have been around 92. It was
500 years?
Yes, it was 500 years. So big Columbus celebrations. And this was a show of artwork, and it was about the fact that Columbus is discovering America and its good and its bad side. It was called Columbus, the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And they said, would you do something for this? So we put together a triptych we had plates made. There were three images that related to the names of Columbus. One in Italian, one in Spanish, because he sailed for Spain, and one in English. And we had these rebus-like images. We collaged images, which we worked together on. We went to the, I remember going to the libraries, and we didn't do it on computer then. We found an image, you know, we put together these kind of funny conglomerate images. So I was involved in those designs very much visually with Marta, and we sat down together and it's sort of interesting. Marta really was always, she would put it together. I don't have that creative ability to make the images so well, but I can actually with collaging. I have a very good eye, kind of a passive eye, and we would kind of, you know, say, what about this? I said, no, let's move it over here. So it was, we really worked together on the visual parts.
I think for Ivan that was a very, because it was never done it before, yeah. And just being able to also visually get involved was good, because it, you know, it did really, from then on, I was very I trust his eye very much. So I never before wanted an input necessarily, and then it was really working out well. And this was a triptych, so it was a flat piece. And
so actually with three, with
three panels.
And it was pretty big on the wall. And again, I said, we're going to do this, just one of these. And I said, we could have done an edition of the triptych, but I said, let's do a book.
Okay.
Because there's enough stuff here. And in addition, each triptych had some text underneath. And the guy who put up the show was very positive about this. He said, that was the best thing in the show. I don't know, but in any case, I realized there was some, having thought about this and come up with those texts, I had more to say also. So I said, let's do a book. So we did the Cologne book. And again, I was very happy with that, and we actually did that one in the basement, right?
Yeah.
It was on this press we had acquired.
And the Cologne has different meanings, and then it's very critical of. So that was, we had a lot of fun working on that book, and it was more a codex kind of binding. So in that one, was very little that we could really integrate it into some.
Yes.
Kind of.
But there was an integration. There was no integration with the book structure. The pages folded out, but they weren't particularly thematic with the structure, just folded out because it was interesting. But there was a tremendous integration of text in these images we had come up with.
Okay.
Yeah.
Those were
rebus-like, and they actually had this kind of, they had like puns built into them, and then they were in the text too. So that was great fun too.
Yeah.
And then Marta did some really wonderful, one-of-a-kind books, in which I didn't do much for those. I did very little.
Well, the one about what goes around comes around is one of
a
kind, and there
was a lot of work done.
A lot of texts in that one.
I forgot about that.
But but that one I had seen the structure.
Uh-huh.
Somebody was showing that structure, and I thought it was cool, but I'm always a little hesitant about those books that you have to assemble.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've seen them, they come in a box and you're supposed to start putting it together, and then once it's together you can view it as a book.
Okay.
I'm a little hesitant about that. I prefer immediate access to the book.
Excuse me, that's what this book is.
Yeah, because
you get it in a box and you put it together.
Okay. And what is this book? It goes around, comes around.
It's
goes around, comes around.
It's they're a bunch of rods that go into a base, and then the signatures radiate out in a circle.
Okay.
Yeah, so they all come, and then you can read the book, and it's endlessly.
Okay.
So Marta said, I want to do a book with this structure.
Mm-hmm.
Can you think of anything to write? And that went back, I forgot about that for a minute. But that's very heavily integrated, because I wrote that again, like the triangle book.
Mm-hmm.
Started with the structure, and I was writing with something visual in mind to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what can I write that fits the structure? In this case, it almost seemed like an imperative, because why would you build that structure if you weren't going to, although some people have used that structure and just put a text in there. And I thought, this is something that goes around in the circle. What goes around in the circle? So it seemed to me that this would be a great book, a great structure to talk about the idea of infinity, because the circle, I mean, two images of infinity. One is a line that never stops, and you can't say, but the other is you go around in a circle, has no beginning, has no end. This called up all sorts of associations to me. Magellan going around the world. So I wrote a text that was about that, and also about
the numbering of the pages.
Also, for example, the pages I don't know how many pages there were, but let's say there were 8 signatures. So the first page would be 1, 9. What would it be? 1, 9, 17, and then dot dot dot. So each page, the pagination suggested an infinite series with no end. So that was built into the book. Also the idea of, I've written this essay a long time ago, I was very interested in this idea of what's called eternal return, that the world history repeats itself eternally, and that we are not the first time here and all of this. So I thought, I can put that in the book, I can put Magellan in the book, and I can put just the idea of the circle being an image of infinity. So we did this text, and it was called What Goes Around Comes Around. So that was, again, that stands with the triangle book very much, where the text is written to a physical shape, and we just don't say, oh, that's a cool shape, we're going to write a nice text and it'll be in this shape because it's unusual. No, it's actually the text the text utilizes that particular structure. And I think if there's anything that distinguished our work from what I saw,
mm-hmm.
and I was looking at book art at that time, is the degree of integration that we aspired to, and I think sometimes achieved to some degree, between the physical form of the book and the content of the text. And I think that was unusual. People remarked on it. One person said, oh, everybody talks about this, but no one really does it, because it's not easy to find a text that goes with the structure that way. You know, you can't write about anything that way. So we were trying to do that, and that seemed almost magical. It was like getting into number magic or shape magic, and it was very exciting. And it also, for me, was they used to talk about right and left sides of the brain. It was like the switch sides of the brain for me from doing
mm-hmm.
normal philosophy. Yet it was very much related. Some of those books were very related. Almost every book had things in it that came from my interest in philosophy.
Speaking of, did your colleagues see your books? What did they say?
let me say this. This happened just before academia decided that interdisciplinarity was a good thing.
Okay.
Yeah,
this before
exactly.
that.
Otherwise, we would have been very.
I think it still wouldn't, because the idea of interdisciplinarity is very strange. But in any case, my colleagues viewed this as probably my
hobby.
A hobby and also a distraction, and maybe one that robbed my attention from what I should be doing. So it was, if anything, neutral. In some cases, maybe negative. I remember when we were in Minneapolis and saw an old friend who was interested in this sort of thing. He was not a philosopher, he was literature, interested in book art. And we were up there to, we had a part of a show, and Martha was one of the jurors on a competition up there. He wanted to see what we had with us, and I showed him, and he said, "What do your colleagues think about this?" I said, "I'm still writing regular stuff." You know, he said, "Oh, okay." But once we had a show at Canterbury, we just one book. They would show different pages.
This
of the
is
book
a bookstore in town that is it's now no longer, but it's still the building there. Yeah. Beautiful, yeah.
And at that time, Martha, who had this endless energy, would actually do letterpress invitations and announcements, and we sent them to all of my departmental colleagues. And
you did?
Yes, I did. And no one, not only did no one come, but that was okay, no one ever mentioned that they had received it.
Wow.
It was very strange. No one said, "Oh, I couldn't come, but it sounds interesting." No, it was omerta. There was silence. I think people did not know. I actually said at some points, I think these things are in some way an expression of some philosophical interests, mm-hmm. especially, I would say, the Carpe Diem book really develops a philosophical view about the present you're supposed to live in. No, there was no, we didn't have the program for visual culture and anything like that. It was, I would say, ignored or viewed in a dim light.
Yeah, but I think that in part is because they wouldn't know what to say. They cannot, in conversations that I had socially at parties where his colleagues were, and when they asked me what I did, and I said, I'm a book artist, the conversation ended there. Because they wouldn't know what to ask me next. Uh-huh. And I think there is this, I don't know what it is with people that, it's more in some fields than others, they are afraid of asking what that is, because it's like, I'm supposed to know it all. You're talking with people in the English department and they want to know more and more and more. And even in Europe, his friends that are also academics, they were all interested. Mm-hmm. And I think it is, I don't know if it was the period where, you know, what you just said about.
I think specialization had hit academia earlier in the United States than in Europe. And I was feeling much more comfortable in Europe. Where people in the humanities were supposed to be educated and still interested in other fields of the humanities, not just in what they did. And in the United States, this has happened all over the world now. There's been a narrowing of the mental outlook of humanists. There may be a counter movement now, but this was really in full swing in the United States, and particularly in philosophy, I have to say. And in Europe, there was a very different approach. And in fact, one of my friends in Germany, who knew my work, a friend in Berlin, when he saw triangles, he said, this is what people will remember you for forever. He said, not, you know, I thought of, he just thought this was terrific. Here, it was considered, I have a friend who, I have several colleagues who kind of have done non-academic things recently, younger, mm-hmm. younger colleagues. And one of them said to me, I said, oh, I couldn't get to the, he had a talk in town, I couldn't make it, but I told him I thought it was great that he had done this book, which wasn't an academic book. And he said, but I'm not claiming this as part of my academic work. And I was thinking,
still, you know,
why not? Because it was about philosophical things, but it wasn't, he's a very productive person. He doesn't have to, but there was this idea that you should only be doing this very professionalized stuff. so there was that kind of tension. I also once asked the graduate school, since I had a fair amount of success at this, for a summer grant, I said, I have an academic project, and I also thought about applying to do one of these books. And the person who interviewed me said, I think it's great that you're doing this, but it will never be funded because you weren't hired to do this. That if you were hired to do one thing and you branch out, this wouldn't be funded. It would be if you branched out within your discipline, perhaps. You know, you started doing 18th century, you went to 19th century, that's okay. But to cut across disciplinary lines at that point was the kiss of death for a grant from the grad school. So I applied for the other project and got it. It just shows you that there was a strange attitude abroad in academia about this sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps tolerated if it didn't interfere with what you were really supposed to be doing, but the idea that this was part of what you were doing as a philosopher or humanist, I think it's better now. I really think it's better now, but there wasn't much encouragement
later,
there.
Later on, your colleague, Lester,
yes.
was very interested in that aspect, in that part of your work that he wanted to put it in the newsletter of the philosophy department, or
yes.
had to like integrated it, but that was more recently.
Yes, but as we were doing it, there was...
Yeah, not a lot of...
There was not a lot of encouragement for this sort of stuff. But it was, I was very happy just doing it. It seemed like...
And I will probably feel even better that there were no philosophers in our presentations, because we actually gave a talk. It wasn't just the exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
But we were asked to give a talk about the work. And it was very well attended by, you know, people that were, at the time, Book Arts was very lively here. And even, to my surprise, some people from the library. At the time, this man who was not kind of in administration, like second to the director of the library, that had lived many years in Germany or gone to Germany to study, something like that. So I think, you know, he came and he was very complimentary of what we were doing. And the head of the library was very...
Yes, he was interested.
Very interested and very encouraging.
And the head of the library at the time was...
Ken Fraser.
Memorial. At the time was Ken Fraser, before... The man that just retired,
mm-hmm.
Not necessarily with funding,
mm-hmm.
but with you know, comments like, and that was very acknowledged.
Yeah.
How is your work going? If we run into each other at social events, he always
mm-hmm.
wanted to talk to me not about the work I was doing in the library, but about my artistic work,
okay.
because he also was very interested in poetry himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he published these chapbooks
mm-hmm.
that were from probably poets around Wisconsin. I don't know exactly. But that was actually very nice. That was very, very much acknowledged within some of my colleagues within the library. Yeah.
And what about other book artists? Because this was not poetry, like, what did they think of what you were doing?
Oh no, a lot of people were positive. Or were also doing, yeah, they liked it a lot. But also, so for instance, Phyllis, who did, she, I don't know how much book work she's done, but at the time, she did a beautiful book where she used an opera as a theme. And it was really beautifully, I hear beautiful lithographs. And so other people that wrote their own things, sometimes they were not necessarily poetry. Mm-hmm. But just lines. Maybe they kept a journal and they wanted to do a book and use some of that. It wasn't not strictly poetry, but mm-hmm. most people use poetry. Yeah.
But I think the reception was in the book world was good, generally very good.
Yeah.
And then there were a lot of things we did that were not full books. I mean, this is a form that's a killer, essentially, because there's so much labor involved. They put out an edition.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an enormous amount of work. And a lot of people don't do it for that long because...
They have somebody who binds them,
mm-hmm.
so they outsource that part. So they have a binder, they have a paper maker, and they would be in charge of the print. I don't know. But
yes.
The work is divided, although it's the idea of the person and everything else, but you will, in our case, I did most of it, including the paper, when I was making paper for the books. Later on, I bought some beautiful handmade papers, but so then you don't really produce more than two a year.
Mm-hmm.
That would be...
And then the sewing, because I did also the sewings, and I enjoyed every aspect of it. I don't think I would have necessarily, you know, pass it on to somebody else to do it. It was all those different elements of making a book. I enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
But we did a lot of smaller projects. Well, ephemera. Think we did, and we really worked at the ephemera. They were also letterpress. They were the same kind of thought went into them, except that they're smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And I even thought at the time we were having all these shows that I was a little. I thought that the standard book show should be superseded in a way. Sometimes I said it might be better to have a show and just show every page of one book than one page of every book.
That's what everybody says. You go to a book, book show, and if you don't have access to the book, then you're gonna be seeing only one page of all these beautiful books, and you want to be able to touch them. Some people don't wanna. I had a copy of when there were a group shows, and I always sent that copy if they wanted that book, because if it was going to be handled just by the people that set up the show or something, you know, it's just, and it's that is a conflict for people that show books, that you would like the book to be gone through, but you know, if it is in a gallery, in a pedestal, people come from outside, they just ate something, they're not careful. And if a book, like we like to do books where the viewer discovers a way of opening the page that is not the codex, just turning pages, you have a lot of interaction and people get involved with them in doing this unfolding of the things. And that all required some supervision or some like guidance. Oh, you now open that, and you know, but so that's sometimes the frustration of book shows. But I also know people that like their book to be just open, like just look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But
and it's nice.
Also, in the book arts, there are people who there's a spectrum of would say a sort of precious quality of the book. We're sort of on the precious end. The papers were hugely expensive. These Japanese papers, a whole village has to make them. They're dying out.
Maybe not anymore.
You know, that Martha liked, thin papers. And some of them you had to know how, and you could see they could be ruined very easily. So you work, a tremendous amount of money in one book, that we didn't want to leave them out just to be gone through. So sometimes I thought, if someone asks us, I'd say, how about just doing one or two, but we'll show almost the whole book. You'll be able to see it opened up in various ways, and you get an idea what it is. Otherwise, I had the feeling, we also had people, a couple of times we had these very fine binders who will buy a copy of your book. They will rebind it. Of course, they're already beautifully bound, but they will rebind it in leather or build a new box for it or something.
No, that there was only one time.
I think two.
And it was a very good friend of mine who is a leather binding. They call them fine binders. And she was very hesitant to ask me because as a person who designs the binding, they said, well, only if you're willing to give me a book, but the only way I could sell it, and I'm sure that this person will love your book, is if I do a leather binding on it. And I, at the time, I thought, that's kind of funny, you know, it's kind of, I never felt like, oh, my binding is going to be transformed. I said, do you think? She said, and she did beautiful work. And she said, I just already have some ideas in how to do that particular one. And it was triangulations.
Okay.
I mean, triangles. And I gave it to her in sheets because the books were not all sewn. So you didn't have to undo the binding.
Okay.
And she made a binding that I never saw because she took it to Europe. She had all her clients in Italy and she sold it. So probably
it
was in a good collection, but that as soon as I gave it to her, it wasn't necessarily my book. And since she had shown me drawings of how she wanted to do it, I said, well, why not? I was not.
There is also, there was a man who rebound Carpe Diem and went all over Europe with his binding in Paris.
Oh, maybe.
It was in Paris and also in Brussels and also in New York.
Mm.
So it happened, but he didn't even have, he just bought the book and did it. It was his book.
Okay.
And then we found out that once these guys rebind it in vellum, it increases like 8 to 10-fold in price.
Yeah.
They were selling it for thousands of dollars.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I was very happy with those
venues. But usually
they
do only one. If they had only one copy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why those bindings are so expensive.
So that was happening, and then there were these collaborative projects where they'd ask different artists to do a page
or
signature.
Yeah, those were fun.
And they were fun, but these things we did were things like solstice cards. We did a number of those.
Equinox
cards we did once. And then there was a thing that we had. I took one of the texts from Triangles. It was from Triangles about means and extremes that. The virtuous action is always between the two extremes. And I kind of developed that, and we did a little piece of ephemera. So we did a number of those, and they were really
and
nice.
And we even have, I have a manuscript that I even had worked, and it was ready to become a book that had a lot of interesting ideas, and it's never come to be done. So maybe that's something the one on Schopenhauer.
Yeah.
That was a good, and now that is more accessibility. At the time, we wanted these important pictures of these men that the we were in Berlin when we went to the library, and they don't allow you to photocopy any of the images, and we wanted, you know, to have them photocopy those for us, and they didn't do a good. So we were still looking for these images, and I'm sure right now we will have more access to that. We needed pictures of him as a young man, as a middle-aged, as an old man, and these pictures are not that available here.
Well, I'm sure they're online
now. Online, all of them. Yeah.
The idea was to do a book about desire. Was actually what mm-hmm. it was about. And he had written about this, and I had written about him on desire and why he was wrong. So I thought, that's a topic that people can relate to. They don't have to be that deeply into philosophy. And he had written that desire is a bad thing, because when you're desiring something, it means you don't have what you want to have. You want things to be the way and they're not. And then when you get it, you get bored with it and you desire again. So, and, you know, this was why life wasn't so positive. And I had written an essay actually called In Defense of Desire, and I thought, and it was published in a journal in England, and I thought this would make a great book. You know, this constellation of ideas. And there's these famous, iconic pictures of Schopenhauer through his career. They're actually on the covers of the standard edition in Germany. When he was young and he was old, and how he gets more embittered looking as he gets older. So I wanted to make fun of what old guys say about desires and what young guys say about desires. And I thought, there's stuff here, you know, I'll work this out. So we were looking for images, and we did go to Berlin where they had images in some special library, and we had them made, and they were not entirely satisfactory. But at that time, to do a book with images made, we have to have plates made, and Marta would print them on the press downstairs.
But yeah, you need a very fine reproduction of it to mm-hmm. have a really good plate made.
Yeah. So that was the project. That was going to be the next project.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the unfinished symphony.
Do you think you'll go back to it?
I mean, I'd like to think we might. We'll see.
Yeah, me too.
We'll see.
My studio is. It still has the smell of ink. I visit it often.
It's
a possibility. Yeah,
I really enjoyed just being in that kind of space where I would do wordplay and jokes, and yet there'd be ideas.
Mm-hmm.
If you've seen the Cologne book, it's got content there about what happened here. It's political to some extent. And I just like to be able to play with it in that way rather than write a kind of didactic essay, making mm-hmm. an argument, making sure everything is well established. It's a kind of freedom playfulness that mm-hmm. I really enjoyed exploring. And another thing that Marta just touched on, but I think we were talking about it this morning, that because the books have unconventional structures, not only on the outside but on the inside, for the reader, it's a voyage of discovery in a sense. You know, you will discover things, not just what it says and what the pictures are, but actually how the book is constructed. You don't know, even when you see that the book is in triangular form, what's about to await you structurally on the inside. So you discover it as you go through it.
Mm-hmm.
And you do it by opening the pages yourself. So it's an experience, a kind of hands-on experience that the book gives you.
Now a lot of books, I've seen books that are... The structures are really interesting, and you mm-hmm. get so involved in manipulating the page. Yeah, a lot of people are working on more visual things in that way,
mm-hmm.
you know. and conventional structures. And,
yeah. Did you want to talk a little bit about your exhibitions? I know you mentioned that, you know, it's a little bit disappointing to have them only at one page, but you were, last time when we talked after recording, you mentioned Woodland Pattern and the Milwaukee Art Museum and some other places. I think in Budapest you had an exhibition. Did you want to talk about any of those in particular, or more generally what those meant to you in the press?
Well,
yeah, we did have very nice opportunities to show the work as a solo press.
Mm-hmm.
So the one in Budapest was a major show.
That was terrific, and, because
we lived there for a year.
Okay.
And I was teaching at the academy,
and
Ivan had been there before he was hired for a year.
I was directing a program for a semester in 89, and I came back in 93, 94. In 89, they wanted me to stay on for another year.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have, you know, without the context of my life, that would have been great, because I was really enjoying, I thought it was very interesting. We had a very interesting life in Budapest.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that that wasn't a good idea for a number of reasons. I wanted to come back here, but I said I told the people I can't do it next year, but I'd be very interested in returning and for a whole year. So they did invite me back, and before I left the first time, I showed some of our work around, and one of my friends said that they were sure that they'd be interested in having Marta be involved in the academy there. So we set that up, and we came
and
back.
Also, when you were there for a semester and I came to visit, I showed slides at the school.
That's right.
Showed
the academy, and they decided they really wanted her to come and teach there. So I came back in 93, we came back, and she had a job at
which was
the academy.
Could you talk about that?
Ivan
travels a lot because
mm-hmm.
of these programs abroad, but I like to come and just visit, because I wouldn't be able to do anymore but being a tourist.
Mm-hmm.
So this time when he talked about going for a year, then the possibility for me to work, that made it very, very attractive, because then I would really have kind of something to do that was interesting to me, and it just worked out beautifully, because I had access to the facilities, not just to teach my classes, but I was also able to work in the type, they have a letterpress they had, more in Budapest, even when computers were already here.
Mm-hmm.
They did everything letterpress in the school, like the forms for the students to apply. Everything was done letterpress. But they were using very powerful machines, because the way newspapers were printed before, they had moved from there. And I had access to the shop, but the machines were machines that I never used before.
Okay.
And the people that worked on those machines were not students. They didn't teach letterpress.
Mm-hmm.
They only taught, they did a lot of book-related things, but the students were never in the type shop.
Okay.
So I was meeting the people that run these presses, and they were older people with no apprentices. So, and they were like really up in years, and they didn't speak any English except Hungarian.
Okay.
So I'm there with no language, and you know, and these very nice men too. to fairly
Spanish, I think.
And one of them had been in a prison during the war, and he hated to learn German or to speak with German speaking. Soldiers, I don't know what they were, or prisoners, I don't know. So he had a friend who was from Spain.
Okay.
And he learned a few words that he never forgot and things. And I was taking Hungarian when I was there. I took the classes. So we were kind of trying to communicate by dictionary and we managed. I managed to do a book. And he assisted me in certain things because of the way that machine worked. And it was just wonderful because I was there for a whole year and we really became good buddies. And
during that year, we were invited to go to the National Library, which is in the castle on the Buddha Hill.
But I taught in the Buddha Hill. The academy was there.
And they looked at our work and said, we would really be interested. Would you be interested in having an exhibition? And we said, yes, that would be great. And in the library, there was this majestic sort of central staircase that you'd see in an opera house, sort of built by the Habsburgs when they were there.
Yes.
And they said, we'll bring in vitrines all the way up these, you know, two steps. They were double steps, right? They came both ways, I think. Anyway, it was this magnificent place. And
so they had a lot of vitrines, and we were able to double the books, show more pages, or have things a little more spread out. And that was at the time when things were changing in that part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the man that used to teach the language class for the American students, that Ivan was directing the program there, became an attaché for
culture.
So when we were going over the following year to have a show, he had, you know, he had all these now different position, you know, and I don't know if it was a show, but I think might be a tradition. They open it up, and there are a couple of politicians there, and he has to talk about, the artist, and we knew him very well because he had been here in Chicago, and we invited him to the house, and he had seen our studio, and he was really wonderful. So it was very personal. It was a really nice event. Yeah.
So we, in those days, you could take more luggage on the plane. We actually would take the books in, what do you call those large flat things? You know, those
portfolios.
Those big portfolios, right into the cabin. We didn't want to check them.
Sure.
We didn't want them to be lost. So we would actually, they were essentially carry-on luggage, which was much more liberal, much more liberal than now, because it's hugely expensive to insure them and send them.
Yeah.
So we put the show up and saw our friends from the year before, and then there was the opening, and then the plan was we would go away, you know, after the show was up for about a week, and we come back.
It was about a week?
No, I mean, we were there about a week.
Yeah, and I returned here, and I went to stay in Europe.
And I went to Europe, and then that I would come back at the end of my time in Europe, which was probably 6 weeks later.
And pick up the show.
And take the show down and take it home with me. And that's what we did. So that show was memorable. We also were invited, we're invited to go on and show our work when we were in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this old city called Lübeck, which is an old Hansa city. And the guy wanted to do a show of our work in the library. And that turned into an event. We did talks. I had to translate with the help of a very brilliant friend, the wife of my friend, she was really great at this. We sat down and actually prepared all the announcements in German together.
Okay.
And we translated those texts from the book. You know, we actually did a lot in about a week, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we stayed there, and we put that show up, and then there were talks and presentations of the show at the library. So that was a big event. So it ranged from this kind of involvement to things where we just sort of sent the work off and there was no funding, so we didn't run all after
sure.
the books all the time, and we just hoped that they'd be taken care of. So there was a show in Dallas that Martha's sister went to because she lives in Texas, but we never went down there. There are a few others that I noticed. So those two shows are quite memorable. And then the last one was a kind of retrospective. We had stopped working, but in the gallery in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And that was in a very nice art gallery. And they did we went down and helped put up the show. And then there was, and that's sort of intense. You have a few days to do that. And,
but it's nice when you can
yeah.
set up your own show, because mm-hmm. then you really know how best to display or which page is the one that you really want
yeah.
to show.
So we
and
control.
Then we had for opening night, there was a talk, and then we were able to show really more the work from the beginning,
mm-hmm.
what we've done and the ideas behind and the you know, the parts that you don't see when you see a book, you know, how it's collaborating,
yeah.
how those things go. So that was nice. I like those shows when you really are able to get more into the background
mm-hmm.
of things and how the ideas develop.
Oh, there was also this show that Martha had been included in a group of book artists to go be shown in the Gutenberg Museum in Germany. I think it was called Americans in Print or something like that.
Yeah.
And I happened to be, it was teaching in Germany at that time for the summer, and Martha said that this is the show, it's going to be opening next week. And I was staying in near Frankfurt in a little town called Bad Homburg, and I said to my friend and host, I said, you know, there's going to be a show in Mainz in the Gutenberg Museum. He said, you want to drive down? I mean, it's not that far. It's
mm-hmm.
like half an hour. There's no traffic. So we went down, and that was, I mean, to be in the Gutenberg Museum was was thrilling, you know, actually. You know, gosh, this is like the home of the book in certain ways. And people seemed very interested, and I noticed all of these, and the books... Martha had, I don't know how many books, maybe three or four?
No, I don't remember.
But I think that was 89. It was after Triangles.
Yeah.
And we had some things open, and I noticed that...
On second thought was open, and you said that some people were taking notes.
That's right. I walked by the case where our stuff was, and there were all of these Germans that had... They were copying... They thought it was interesting enough to copy. They sort of touched me. I thought this is interesting. And we ended up selling a book to them at the
uh-huh.
end. They bought something.
Which was nice.
But,
a couple of things.
That was another really nice experience
mm-hmm.
with a show where at least I was able to. Shame Arthur wasn't there, but you know, the Americans weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
They had sent the work over. And you know, some of the
interactions
yeah.
with the people in the Red Book collections,
mm-hmm.
For instance, we've had a couple of interesting interactions in the Victoria and Albert, and then there was a woman that is part of the British Library, but she does the Ibero-America area.
Okay.
So she got more interested and focused on the books that we did with Spanish
mm-hmm.
yeah,
poets or But then you get to know them, and they, you know, it's that part sometimes is very enjoyable. We got to meet different people in the New York Public Library, because when you have a dealer, and the dealers really are the ones that do these routes, they go because they have their clients. And once in a while, if you visit, and they said, oh yeah, I said, we know you have our work, and we just have a new book, and we were wondering if you wanna look at it. And the woman in the New York Public Library said, she said, oh yeah, we'd love to meet you. So we came over, we had a really nice talk, and then at the end she said, but you know what, I'm a client of your dealer.
Okay.
So I'm sure I will get it through your dealer.
Yeah.
And I like that too. I like the one that the fact that they're very upfront. And we said the thing with the dealers is that sometimes they don't necessarily tell you where they place the work.
Okay.
Not always. So it's always kind of nice, and if they want to buy it directly, perfect. But now, as I mentioned it earlier, I don't know, that dynamic has changed a lot. There are still dealers, but less, because people are selling directly through their websites, which is great, because sometimes through a dealer you lose some money.
You always lose a percentage.
But lose in the way that they do such a good job. Our dealers were wonderful. I have to say that they did show the book a lot.
One shouldn't generalize. They're dealers and dealers. I mean, there was one I liked a lot, but she was very straightforward and lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And she said, here's the deal. Once I sell one of your books, then you don't sell to them. I keep selling your books to them.
Okay. Oh, okay.
You know, because I developed that client.
That client, yeah.
Okay, and I said, well, you just tell me who they are. But of course, sometimes the dealers have a lot to show, and they don't show everything. And you go around, like New York had already bought a book, and we were the ones who took the trouble to come in and show this book and said, oh yes, we really want that, but I'm going to buy it to the dealer, and they'll get whatever percentage they got. I can't remember what it was. That was okay, but we had another dealer who wouldn't tell us where she was selling because she thought maybe we would then try to, you know, sell on her clientele, the clientele development. I said, no, you know, if it's yours, it's yours. But there are places that where I go to Europe that no dealer had gotten to, or they weren't carrying every book they had, so they didn't develop. You develop yourself. That was. In a way, it was fun for a while. It was energy consuming, but and there were great experiences, and of course, they're frustrating experiences. And some people very nice and receptive, and other people not so. So I mean, this is any artist will tell you, whatever the work is, it can be unpleasant to sell your prints or paintings, or it can be terrific. But we did get involved for a bit in that sort of thing, and it was a good way. Also, when I travel, it was a way I had something to do, not just be a tourist. You know, I get involved, I meet people, get under the surface, and I enjoyed that part of it too. Mm.
Did you do any trades with other book artists? I know sometimes that would happen.
Yeah, yes, of course, we did. We did exchange books, ephemera a lot. That was part of
more ephemera.
Okay. But I have more of the people that were here. For instance, we with Kathy Keene, I have some of her books. She has some of my books.
Yeah.
With Diane Fine. Yeah, no, it's very satisfying to give something that. You know, it's going to be received in such, you know. And yeah, the people that we have given some of our books, they have them in, they have liked their work. They've been in many ways very supportive. And so, yeah.
I know last time you had mentioned that with working full-time that it's hard to find time for your projects.
Right.
And I think that that's something that a lot of artists struggle with. And I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that, about your experiences or not.
Yeah, I think that's when I started doing less and less work, because for a long time my job allowed for me to have a quality time in my studio, the same job that now I have full time. And then at the beginning I struggled, I kept doing things, no? We were working on one-of-a-kind pieces, because you always, people always want to know, are you working on something new? I would love to see it. And for a long time, I identified myself not as a conservator. I love what I do in conservation, but I was primarily a book artist. So I kept busy with my hands or with my head just thinking about the next project. And just as it always happens, the job becomes more demanding. And I unfortunately have no assistants except the students who I have to train. I have to do all the training. It's just time consuming. I run the lab in every level, at every level, and the computer. I mean, things have changed so much in the library with the digital. World that the university is putting a lot of effort and money on that, so they have to take away from other places, and we have never been able to create another position where I will be able to have somebody to assist me more. And then I just get consumed by the work, and when I have free time, it's not enough to really do quality work in my studio. And also, I like to travel, and usually that's what we sometimes do.
Yeah. You know, let me just mention one other thing about the book arts that not on your list, and that is For me, there was always it was both an attraction and an obstacle. This preciousness of and the delicacy of the product. And we mentioned couldn't just leave the book out and people go through, because then you'd lose, you know, it'd be gone. You couldn't sell that again. You'd lose that one. I often thought maybe we should let some time go by and do more popular editions, which would mean farming the work out. You know, go to some place, because sort of the images and the text are there, so Marta doesn't have to sew every one. You know, we're not going to go through that. That a couple of those things, I would not for financial reasons. Just I'd like to see them maybe more widely distributed and available. More people get to take a look at them, because I think there'd be interest. So, like if they were, I never try to organize this, but I thought, wouldn't it be nice maybe to get someone in these places to do a, you know, 300 copies of a version of Triangles or something like that.
Which places?
Well, there were some places that were doing, they weren't huge editions, but they do like 300 copies of a Claire Van Vliet's book. I don't even remember where it was, but you know, somebody, there might be a press interested in that does something of that niche. I don't know if it exists now or ever did.
I'm sure it does. I mean,
that might be.
We never discussed this.
I want to know what your opinion is.
I don't know. I just think, yeah, if it is more popular, then it will be more accessible. I don't think, from what I see now in people's websites, the prices they're asking for some of their work, I'm thinking, could I still make these books and sell them the way I feel? You know, it's a one the amount that I need, that I want, that I think it is, which was what we did before. I don't know. I don't know if people are willing to pay that much money for the books that are published with such cause and such. I just wish I could see the books that they're selling for $25 on the website.
Yeah, some of them are just.
And I'm thinking, wow, this is, and since I'm not so much in contact with how, you know, the dealers are doing, I don't know what the quality of the work is. I
think that there still are a lot of books that are on the higher end.
Oh, yes. Oh, I'm sure Tinili's work, and I've seen books from very established artists, and not all the books are that inexpensive. I recently saw books that are $1,300-$1,400.
Yeah.
The fine editions, they also have, they've done that.
Yeah.
Where they do the fine editions and they have some fancy something, and then they do the less, the more popular edition.
I would, for me, it's not very practical. I just think it'd be nice that these things got more exposure somehow, you know,
yeah.
Because they were. I can imagine someone doing, for example, Cologne.
Yeah.
And, you know, it would still be our images that we put together. So it'd still be our work in that way. Still be the text. I could imagine Cologne being put out by somebody. I don't know if there's anybody who's really interested or whether they're doing that. But
maybe that would be the next thing to approach. So we just
outsource
it for a popular edition.
I think, but the truth is that would have to be outsourced because it's just.
Well, if it is going to be commercially printed,
yeah.
They will probably do everything else, the bindings and everything. Yeah,
yeah, but we would, you know, it would be nice if we
could
collaborate on some of the, you know, what it looks like. We don't want to have it come out in some horrible color or something like that. But if we could find someone who would work with us, but they would have machines probably. Well, that's what we're talking about.
I'm sure.
We're not talking about
hiring
Bangladeshi to do this.
Yeah, it's something that we've never explored, and I'm sure there is a lot of people probably doing that.
Yeah, I always thought that might be interesting because I think a couple of those things are worth just putting out there. I think it'll be satisfying for both of us to do that, and maybe actually get around to Desire and Schopenhauer some at some point.
Yeah, that's our desire, to finally get to that.
Yeah.
Marta, I did want to get back to your teaching in Budapest. What did you teach? Did you teach book arts?
Yes,
you did.
I taught book arts, and it was a whole year.
Mm-hmm.
But it works in, I divided it in quarters.
Okay.
And I was doing all the teaching in English, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So the students were, I had a group of 9 students, and they were all aware that the class was gonna be taught and directed in English.
Okay.
But I divided it in a way that was very comprehensible with handouts. So we did one that was just book structures. So we play a lot with that, different kinds of structures. And since there was a small class, I was able to work with each person.
Mm-hmm.
And a few of them spoke English very well. They had never been outside Budapest, but their English was very good. And they kind of, you know, explained to the others that were not completely able to understand certain things. And then we did book binding, And these classes, most of the time, I was doing the teaching. So they did what I asked them to do, and they brought another structure that they did on their own. But the last class was more about making, now they had all the tools, they knew how to do the structures, the bindings, and they were working with some visual things. So the last class, they just had to produce a book, and we met for critiques and that, and they were a little intimidated, because that's not the way the other classes. They said, no, we were always told what to do. I cannot just come up with my own idea from beginning to end. I have to have some guidelines. I said, no, you're going to have your book. You can bring any text you want to it,
mm-hmm.
and develop the idea around that text. So it was a class that very interesting. They came up with very interesting things, very visual, because
mm-hmm.
my work was very tactile and very visual, and I worked usually with structures that were fun, and you know, so at the end they did really interesting things, and some were very conceptual, so it was a very, very great experience. They did have this way of relating to professors, like, oh, the professor is up there and I'm up here. And I used to, every time we finish a quarter, I used to invite them to have coffee somewhere, and they were a little shy. And we developed very good friendships,
yes.
With some of them, because they wanted to bring us to their home.
Mm-hmm.
And we kept in touch with a few after we came back, and some came to the United States to have to do the graduate work,
mm-hmm.
and so it was a really, really interesting group that developed nicely.
Mm-hmm.
They used to send me, you know, reports of what they were doing at the moment, but they were primarily graphic designers.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I think that I saw some of the work, and I think Martha had a huge impact on these people. Their work really sort of came out of that. I think also might be interesting for Martha to talk about her experience. We officially both went to Haystack to teach, but I had a relatively small role there. That was a very interesting experience. That was what, a 2 week?
2 week. And we lived all in this air, in this place, which is beautiful,
an
and people work. The studios are open for the whole day and night if they want to.
Okay.
And the classes are within a certain amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
But then I always was accessible, and in the studio. So if they wanted to learn some more, if they wanted to, I was there to guide them. And at the end, there is an exhibit. There are many different crafts taught there.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, the studios put up everything they've done, the students have done. And then a lot of people from outside come and look at the work. And it was really interesting to see the work finished. They had been very productive. So it was a great experience. I love teaching small groups, kind of workshops.
Mm-hmm.
Because they really, if they're signing up for it, because they bring a lot of energy. I had very well, very, very accomplished people in my club. Somebody that had a show at the Modern Art,
okay.
in a completely different field. She was she worked with fabrics, and she had done this show. And so another person was a writer, but also book artist, and
no, there was an
graphic designer, an architect so people that were all ages, no, some more mature than others, and then you have these people being really responsive and excited about what they're doing. So it's good. It's not a classroom when people are taking that class because they have to, or yeah, I that's part of one of the aspects I enjoy also in my conservation work. I have and develop my students' the skills.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always very rewarding when they, you know, and for them as well, because they are, sometimes they're not, they don't have any art background.
Mm-hmm.
They're engineers or English majors. They just love books. And then, you know, even though it's very technical what we do in conservation, they also have to become resourceful and bring some of the aesthetics with them. And, you know, they're good. And it's just a really good interaction, that part with the students, the way some have decided to change their field and go into the conservation.
I wanted to ask you about that. How many, or can you talk a little bit about that, how some of them have gone into conservation? What they've done after they've worked with you?
Yeah, there are a couple, although they had an idea,
mm-hmm.
or they had an interest. And these are students that have come from art history majors.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, you know, they just want a job in the library, in the conservation lab. They start working with paper,
mm-hmm.
and books, and they kind of see that maybe developing into something else. And two of these students have gone into conservation and done very well. They went to the program for book conservation,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't exist anymore. So the authors that now that I've had after these people and after they closed the program have shown a lot of interest as a possibility. And I said, well, there are places where you can go and further your experience, and work on different, you know, different conservation labs approach things, not totally different, but it's nice that they can get an internship somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no such thing as a degree yet. I think some universities are developing some conservation programs. NYU, I know, they are doing, I don't know if it is just conservation, book conservation, or if it is art conservation as well. It's interesting how they really get into it, and they,
mm-hmm.
they inquire about the possibility of continuing doing it. And the most recent student that just graduated, she's pursuing it and trying to get, she just got an internship in Seattle at the university, and her background is art history within Asian art, and also she was taking the class, the book class, Jim Escalante's class, and with also she learned a lot in my lab. She said that brought the two things together, and she's going to pursue conservation and wants to spend, she already spent time in Japan in a conservation lab,
right.
And so she's just, not because of the lab, but she needed to work in the lab to see what the more possibilities are. So it's very brave, because there is no such thing as a program yet. I hope the one in NYU develops really well. You wanted to say something?
Oh.
So you were...
I just had one more question. I wondered if you had any thoughts about how your background in book arts impacted your work in the conservation lab. Like, how do you see the connection?
Oh, I think it is, it's one of the reasons why I wanted to get a job in conservation.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, books have always been my interest in making them, and when you work in conservation, you are exposed to so many different types of books, and you sometimes have to take them apart to put them together, and I think it complements really well the skill in particular that you have to be confident with your skills, because you're going to be dealing with books that are falling apart in some cases. So I think that sometimes that complement each other. I know of some people that work in conservation that never thought about doing book arts, and then they also go the other way. So it's not that uncommon. I know a lot of friends that do both.
Okay.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting that way, that a lot of book people end up in book conservation labs or the other way around. But some people want the job of book conservation because it's more reliable as an income. Although I'm not so sure anymore, but I was doing pretty well when I was able to do my own work, and I think that the aspect of being, you know, working on a book that is really falling apart and bring that book back to life is almost as satisfying of really making a book of our own from beginning to end. But it is you feel like an accomplishment.
Thank you very much, both of you. I'll stop it here.